Thanks, Daniel. For those in the back, there seems to be a few seats left in the front. All right, so in this talk, I want to address the issue of quantum non-locality and how can it be simulated classically and at what cost. So the context is Alice and Bob, our usual suspects. Alice and Bob share an entangled quantum state, psi. And they can make measurements. So this state is shared between them. It's a bipartite entangled state. And they can make measurements. They can each make a measurement, and they get some outcome. And now quantum mechanics tells us that as a function of which state they share and the pair of measurements they make, well, they will get outcomes. And this will be defined by a probability distribution. So there's some probability for each possible pair of outcomes as a function of the two measurements for a fixed state psi. And the question today is, can this probability distribution, P, can it be explained locally? Can it be explained by just Alice and Bob on their own receiving their measurements, x and y, and can they produce the outputs A and B without any communication and without actually having this quantum state? Of course, the answer is no. And let's be slightly more specific. When I ask, can they reproduce this probability distribution, what I mean is that can this theory, quantum mechanics, can it be supplemented with local hidden variables? So this is a question that it's an old question, and it was really asked by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, not in those terms, but we can read that into their paper if we want to. We don't have to. So in 1935, the question was, is it possible to explain the behavior of quantum mechanics by local hidden variables? And what that means is that instead of having this quantum state between Alice and Bob, what we want, or what they wanted, is to replace this quantum state by lambda, which is this so-called local hidden variable. Namely, lambda is some parameter that Alice and Bob share, but it's purely classical. So maybe lambda was chosen by nature in some random fashion, but at the time the state psi was created, in fact, there was some lambda which was classically shared between Alice and Bob. And what it means to obtain this probability distribution classically is that the probability of A and B will depend not only on X and Y, and previously, of course, it depended on psi, but now it's going to depend on X and Y and lambda. But, well, I assume you all know that the answer is no, it's not possible. And this is the famous Bell theorem. So in 1964, Bell proved it's not possible. One cannot explain quantum mechanics by a local hidden variable theory. Now, this is a general colloquium of parameter as opposed to a specialized colloquium or seminar on quantum information. So I'm not sure how much I would expect you to be familiar with these notions like entanglement. In case not, I have a few slides to illustrate what is meant by entanglement. And please bear with me if you're entirely familiar with it. They might be entertaining anyways. So entanglement is a phenomenon that was discovered by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, as I said, in 1935. And it was immediately recognized by by Schrödinger, as being really very, very important. In fact, Arthur Eckert has sent his students scavenger in Schrödinger's old notes, and they found that he may have invented entanglement several years before 1935, although he didn't publish it. But nevertheless, he was entirely aware of the importance of this discovery, calling it the characteristic that enforces our entire departure from classical line of thought. And I like to illustrate entanglement when I give a general public talk in the following way. Well, entanglement will occur when two particles interact somehow at some point, although it's in some cases possible to get two particles entangled without having them interact at any time, directly at least. But let's say that two particles interact, they get entangled. And what it means to be entangled is I like to illustrate it with these sculptures. This is a sculpture garden. I mean, it's taken from a sculpture garden in Oslo. It's full of sculptures. I've never been there. I must go sometime. So these two characters will represent our two particles. And the idea of entanglement, Charlie Bennett likes to say that two entangled particles are like two hippies who have no opinion about anything. But when you ask them a question, they will answer randomly because they had no opinion previously. But it would all. But as an old couple, they will always answer the opposite. So the illustration of entanglement is that you ask a question to these two people, any question, any yes/no question. It has to be binary for this to work. For instance, heads or tails, and they had no preconceived idea what they would say. So one of them tosses a coin and says tail, but the other one will necessarily see the opposite. So. But this is true for any question. For instance, you could ask whatever you ask. They have no opinion initially. They choose at random, and they always choose the opposite. And what makes entanglement interesting is that it will work regardless of, at the moment, they're just next to each other, so they could be cheating. But in fact, even if they're separate, even if they're arbitrarily far apart, it still works. And what quantum mechanics tells us, as Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen discovered, is that even though quantum mechanics tells us that the answer is not predetermined, no matter how far these two characters are apart, and no matter how closely in time the question is asked, when you ask the same question, you always get opposite answers. So this seems like it would entail arbitrarily fast communication between them. One of them chooses at random and tells the other what to say. If we try to explain it classically, that's about the only way you might think of doing it, although there are other ways. But of course, trying to give a classical explanation for quantum mechanics is a sin. So quantum mechanically, that's how it works. And if all you could ask these two characters were the same question, so you choose your question, but if the only test you do to this theory is ask the same question to both of them, and you always get opposite answers, well, you could suspect that, in fact, they're just pre-programmed with an answer, a random answer perhaps, but an answer already chosen for any possible question, and they're pre-programmed to give the opposite answer. And with this explanation, purely classical explanation, there'd be no mystery at all. Where entanglement becomes interesting is because you could ask them different questions, and when you ask them, which is not illustrated here, but when you ask them different questions, correlations will take place, some joint probability distribution, as I showed just before. And that distribution, the distribution that you would expect for all possible questions, even if you ask them different questions, that distribution, that's what Bell's proved, cannot be explained by answer that would be pre-established between them. But that's Bell's theorem. All right. So this notion of non-locality can be used for a variety of things. It's central in entanglement-based quantum cryptography, like Eckert discovered. It can be used. It's quantum computation uses entanglement all the time. And let's not go through this, but there are all kinds of things you can do. Entanglement is really at the heart of quantum information science. Good. Now, what we want to do in this talk is to quantify non-locality, quantify how non-local is entanglement. And there are many ways to do that. So how the quantum mechanics is this. On the left, we have quantum mechanics with an actual quantum state shared between this and Bob. On the left, we're trying to explain it or to approximate, to simulate that using a purely classical scenario with local hidden variables. And the question is, how far are, this is reality, this is an attempt at simulating, how far are they apart? And the farther apart they are, the more non-local is quantum mechanics. So how can we quantify how far they are apart? Well, one natural way is that the one that we're doing here is to allow Alice and Bob to communicate. Now, what Bell proved is that if Alice and Bob do not communicate, then no matter what this local hidden variable is that it would have set ahead of time, they won't be able to simulate quantum mechanics. But if we allow them to communicate, it's a different game. So let's do that. Now we're going to allow Alice and Bob to communicate back and forth as much as they want. And we're going to quantify the amount of non-locality by how much communication they need to do to simulate the effect of quantum mechanics. That's the game we want to play. And even though it would be perfectly reasonable to allow Alice and Bob to share a local hidden variable in addition to communicating, it's also interesting to see what happens if you don't allow it. So again, how much communication is required? And let's not necessarily allow this shared random variable. So now the question becomes, Alice and Bob, they know what they want to simulate. They know what the game is. They know which quantum state they're supposed to have, even already don't have it for real. They're purely classical. They're allowed to communicate, and they want to simulate the effect of entanglement, the effect of this, what would happen if they had this state which they don't have. And you want to do simulation strictly by classical communication and as little as possible. That's the game. All right. Now, what do we want to simulate here? Certainly, we cannot hope to simulate everything that a real entangled quantum state can do. So that's not the game. For instance, one thing that we cannot simulate classically is quantum teleportation. Now, this is not a talk about teleportation. Teleportation, as you might know, is not this. So there are things that you will not be able to simulate, things that quantum mechanics can do that classical communication cannot do instead of it. So that's so we want to be more restricted on what it is that we want to simulate, and specifically we're going to want to simulate the effect of measurements. And that's a scenario I gave before. Alice and Bob, they each receive a measurement that they have to pretend that they're doing on their quantum state, even though they don't have the quantum state for real. So they receive this measurement from outside. They don't know ahead of time which measurement, and they can very well receive different measurements. And they have to produce the outcome and do that strictly classically and produce the outcome with the same probability distribution, exactly the same, not an approximation, as if they had the quantum state to do it. So if you had a quantum state, they would not need to communicate. They don't have it. How much communication do they need? Okay, so they want to simulate the effect of measurements. This question, in fact, is pretty old. It was first asked, as far as I can tell, by Tim Modlin in 1992. And Modlin, the question that he considered at that time is, Alice and Bob share a pair of entangled photons in polarization, for instance. And what they want to simulate is they receive arbitrary polarization angle to measure. So if they receive the same angle, let's say that they want to simulate a singlet state. So if they receive the same angle, they have to produce two opposite bits all the time, but at random. If they receive orthogonal angles, they have to produce the same bit. If they receive two angles at 45 degrees, they have to produce uncorrelated random bits and all that. So they have to do the same thing as quantum mechanics would do when you do a polarization measurement, two independent polarization measurements on a singlet. And in what Modlin did in 92, he would only consider linear measurements, linear polarization. So polarization angle. He did not consider circular or elliptical polarizations. And so it was restricted, but very interesting, because still the question is, how can we get exactly the right probability distribution, not an approximation? And he was able to do it with slightly more than one bit of communication, but that was an expected case. In other words, his protocol could require, there was no upper bound on how many bits Alice and Bob would have to communicate. If they're unlucky, they would need to keep sending more bits. But on the average, the expected number of bits of communication was just slightly more than one bit, with no upper bound again. And in his paper, he argued that it's not possible to have a simulation with a fixed upper bound, worst case upper bound on the amount of communication. But he was wrong, because with Richard Cleave and Anna Tapp, totally unaware of Modlin's work, 7 years later, we were able to do it with eight bits of communication, but in the worst case. So we found a protocol, if we would do the same thing as Modlin, it would be four bits. With four bits of communication, no matter what happens, we're able to simulate exactly the effect of a linear polarization measurement on a pair of singlets. Two independent measurements. So again, the scenario is Alice gets an angle, Bob gets an angle from some adversary, perhaps, and no matter which angles they receive, they're able to produce each one bit, and the probability distribution of the pair of answers, given the pair of measurements, is exactly what it should be with quantum mechanics. And they do that with exactly four bits of communication between them, even though the angles all have infinite precision. And here I wrote eight, because with eight bits, we can also do the elliptical polarization measurements. And then, so it is possible to do it in worst case, contrary to what Modlin thought. And then Steiner, so we were unaware of Modlin's work, and then Steiner, unaware of both of us before, Steiner, at about the same time as my paper with Cleave and Tapp, Steiner found a solution which took slightly less than 1.5 bits expected case. So Steiner went back to the expected case, unaware that Modlin had done it before. So it looks like he's not as good. He's after Modlin, not as good, but not exactly, because Steiner could also do the elliptical polarization measurements, which Modlin did not consider. And then, big surprise. Then Serge Zayn Massar, aware of all that went before, except past Modlin, I'm not sure, reduced it to slightly 1.19 bits, a bit more than Modlin, but again, they could do an arbitrary measurement, not only an arbitrary polarization measurement, not only linear measurement. And then that was also the expected case. And then the big surprise came when Turner and Bacon found that a single bit of communication, worst case, is enough. So this subsumed everything before. And it's totally mind-boggling. If you've never heard of this before, good look at that paper. It's not exactly easy to read. It's very, very subtle that we did that. But it's mind-boggling that it's possible. Let me just try to share my awe with you by repeating what this is. Alice and Bob each receive an arbitrary, unpredictable measurement, not only angle, but von Neumann measurement, projective measurement, polarization measurement, but it doesn't have to be linear. It could be elliptical. On their share of a singlet, and they each produce an output bit with exactly the right probability distributions, as if they had a singlet, but they don't have it. They do that strictly classically. They get the exact right distribution, strictly classically, and with a single bit of communication. It's amazing. And then Turner again, but with Regev. But at that point, until then, it was only we could only do maximally entangled pair of qubits, like a singlet or a Bell state. We could not do an arbitrary and bipartite entangled state, and we could not do a bigger dimension, more than only one qubit each. But then Turner with Regev was able to do the much more general case of an arbitrary bipartite entangled state, and an arbitrary measurement on each side, but the measurement had to be Boolean valued, and with only two bits instead of one. I open a parenthesis. One thing interesting here is that it seems that it's harder to simulate a non-maximally entangled state than a maximally entangled state. So does it mean that there is more non-locality in entanglement when it's not maximally entangled? I'll leave it to you. But these are the facts. Although I don't think that we have proved that one bit is not enough in general. All right. So all of this is about bipartite states. And this talk is about multipartite states. So the case of the bipartite state is pretty much entirely under control. Now what happens, oh, by the way, I wasn't talking about Bell states all along. They're here, in case you don't know. These are the Bell states. So we know how to simulate my t-shirt classically. And the question is, if we want to go beyond my t-shirt, how can we do it? Or can we do it? And so how about simulating multi-party entanglement? All right. Now again, what we want to simulate, so we have the scenario is that we have n parties. They share an arbitrary, in the most general case, which we won't do here. But we have n parties. They share some big entangled state between them. And you want to simulate what it could do if they had it when they don't have it. And again, the answer is it's not possible to simulate everything. And we're concentrating on simulating the effect of measurements. And we're going to restrict the measurements to being von Neumann measurements, projective measurements. In what follows, I'm going to restrict each of the n parties, to having a single qubit. So it's an n qubit entangled state. And each of the n parties will receive a projective measurement, a von Neumann measurement, to make on his qubit, giving one bit outcome, and want to simulate the output as a function of the inputs, without the state being there, only with classical communication. So since this talk is about simulating the effect of measurements, I need to just refresh you or tell you what's a von Neumann measurement. I won't get into details of what really it is, but just of what the parameters are. So a von Neumann measurement is a complete measurement on a single qubit, and the parameters of this measurement can be given by a point on the 3D sphere, the Bloch sphere. So we take the 3D sphere, take a point on it, and a von Neumann measurement is defined simply by which point on the sphere, on the surface of the sphere, you take. Now, any point on the surface of a sphere can be parametrized by two angles. There are many ways to describe one point in the sphere, but in particular by two angles. So you take, let's say, the x-axis. You turn it by some angle theta. And then you raise it by some angle phi. So theta, we would call theta the azimuthal angle, and phi the elevation angle, which could be up or down, plus or minus. And that defines a point on the sphere, which, if you wanted its Cartesian coordinates, would be given like this, but we don't really care. So any complete projective measurement on one qubit can be parameterized by these two angles. And the outcome of the measurement is either plus one, If the qubit that you measure agrees with this point, it would be plus one. And if, in fact, it decides to go the other way, it will be minus one. So when you measure the qubit, it will collapse to either plus one or minus one. It collapses to either what you asked it for the measurement or its orthogonal, which would be here in this case. So the effect of the measurement is would give you plus one or minus one. And some specific type of measurements, if you restrict the angle, if you restrict phi to be zero, then we call that an equatorial measurement because it's on the equator of the sphere. So equatorial measurements correspond to the elevation angle being zero, and they will play a role. One particular type of equatorial measurement is the one in which theta also is zero, and that's the well-known Hadamard measurement. So the Hadamard measurement is equatorial with angle zero, whereas the measurements in the computational basis are the two poles of this sphere. So in a computational basis, you take phi to be plus or minus pi over 2, and then theta doesn't matter anymore. And so if you take phi being plus pi over 2, then you either get plus 1 as a result or minus 1, depending on which pole you get. All right. Back to the question. How do we simulate multi-part A states? Well, in particular, we're going to concentrate on one specific n-partite state, which is a generalization of an idea of Greenberger, Horn, and Zeininger, which is this state. So if you had n particles entangled in that state, and if you do a measurement in the computational basis of any of the qubits, you get a random answer. But if you were to make the same, again, a measurement in the computational basis of the other qubits, you would get the same answer. So it's like our two characters that we had in the sculpture park, but you have n of them. And this time, in fact, you would always give the same answer, as opposed to different. Of course, they cannot give all different answers. They're only binary answers, so it had to be the same answer. However, in this case, they would only give the same answer if you ask a specific question, which is, if I were to measure you in a computational basis, what would you say? Somewhat boring question. But if you ask different questions, they would no longer give the same answer. And so the game we're playing here specifically is that we have n parties, and we give one qubit of this state to each party. So the first party gets the first qubit, second party gets the second qubit, and so on. So they each have their qubit of the state. And then if we're really doing quantum mechanics, they would each have one qubit of that state. We would want to simulate that without it. But what we want to simulate is the effect of they do share this state. They each receive a measurement to make, and each measurement is parameterized by two angles, as before. So they each receive a pair of angles, and they each have to give a pair of bits. But of course, the outcome now is plus or minus one instead of zero or one. And what we want is, the real quantum mechanical scenario defines a probability distribution. And this is the distribution that we want to simulate. So instead of having this GHZ state, instead of that, they have just access to classical communication. And how much classical communication is needed to get the exact correct probability distribution? Each party receives only his own pair of angles and is unaware of the other angles. And with as little communication as possible, they want to get the exact correct quantum mechanical probability distribution on the outputs that it will give. That's the problem. All right, history. The simulation of the bipartite state has, as I told you, a more than 20-year-old history. This question has been studied more recently. And in particular, in the case of equatorial measurements, not because they're so interesting, but because they're much easier to do. It just turns out that in the case of equatorial measurements, the probability distribution of the outputs depends on the inputs, of course. But any marginals, if you remove any party, if you remove any one or more parties, the parties which are left have an output which is uniformly distributed. So in the case of equatorial measurements, it's easy because you only have to, it's not that easy, but it's easier, because you only have to reproduce the n-partite correlation. And then it's fairly easy to uniformize the thing so that all marginals are uniform without changing the n-partite correlation. And then you have the complete simulation. So because you only have to care about this n-partite correlation and not about the marginals in case of simulating equatorial measurements, the solution was found earlier. And in particular, the first, I worked on that and was beaten at the finish line by Nicolas Gizet and his two students in 2010. And they were able to do the three-partite GHZ state with 10 expected bits of communication. And 20 bits, so 10 bits for three-partite and 20 bits for four-partite. They were not able to get beyond n equal 4. And then I was able, and then in the case of n equal 3, they had a major improvement, not only from 10 to 3 bits, but 3 bits worst case. And this result, as far as I know today, is still the only result known for the simulation of multipartite, meaning more than bipartite, entanglement, in this case tripartite, with a worst case number of bits of communication. Everything else that I know how to do will be in the expected case. So this result has not been subsumed by anything I'm going to tell you. But I was able, with my postdoc, Marc Kaplan, to get a simulation for arbitrary n a couple years later with an amount of communication which is quadratic in number of parties. But that's only for equatorial measurements. There was also a proof, a much, much earlier proof, that you cannot simulate even equatorial measurements with less than n log n communication. So there is a lower bound of n log n for simulating n-partite measurements on a GHZ state, even if you restrict to equatorial measurements. And the question is, can we go beyond that? Can we handle the case of non-equatorial measurements? And let me just give you the punchline, and then I'll tell you a bit more how to do it. And the punchline is that, yes, we can do it. We can do it with quadratically many bits. So it's as good as we had here, but we can do an arbitrary von Neumann measurement, not only equatorial. And our technique in the case of equatorial measurements, in fact, gives an improvement. We can do it in n log n. So n log n bits is enough to simulate arbitrary equatorial measurements on the n-partite GHZ state. It's enough, and it's necessary. So that's optimal. However, if we consider a scenario in which we allow parallelism, in which we allow, if instead of counting how many bits have to be exchanged, if instead we count how many time steps, by allowing as in one time step, allowing two pairs of people to communicate one bit at the same time, then we can reduce that from n squared and n log n to n log n and log square n. So in terms of time, in a parallel model, we can do much better. Okay. So that's what we want to do. We want to simulate this probability distribution with classical communication. At this point, the talk gets more technical, because I'm going to tell you how to do it. So until now, it was entertaining. Now here's how to do it. So if we want to simulate this distribution, I have to tell you what it is. What is a distribution, mathematically speaking? So as a function of the pair of angles that each party gets, so we have n pair of angles, as a function of all this input, what is the per distribution of the n bits of output? Well, there is a well-known formula for that, which I will not give you. Instead, I will give you a massaged version of it, which is the key to doing it. So what we found is that this perp distribution of the b is a vector here, a vector of n outputs as a function of the vectors of n theta angles and n phi angles. Well, we found that we can express this perp distribution in this way, which is, and the reason why it's interesting is that this where this angle theta here is just the sum of the angles, the sum of the theta angles that each participant gets. And why this is interesting is that this can be seen as a convex decomposition, where a cosine square of theta over 2 or sine square of theta over 2 determines whether you want to do P1 or P2. So once you have this decomposition, in order to obtain B with the right probability, the first thing you do, it's not obvious as such, but the first thing you do is to choose at random one bit with probability cosine square theta over 2. It's not obvious because nobody has theta. Theta is the sum of all the thetas which are distributed, but still, bear with me for a moment. So the first thing to do is to toss a coin with probability cosine square theta over 2. And if you get heads, then you simulate, then you output B with probability P1. And if you get tails, then you output B with probability P2. And the reason why this is interesting is that it's not so hard to do this Bernoulli choice between these two possibilities. And once you've done this choice, it's not too hard either to do either P1 or P2, whichever is the case. All right. So again, it's a convex decomposition of two easier to sample distributions. Now, P1 and P2, when I said they're easier than P, that's true. This is what they look like. Now, when you look at it, it doesn't look all that easy. P1 and P2 are given by these sum or plus or minus of the A1s or A2s, whatever. A1 and A2 are defined like this. And the alphas and betas are defined like that. So it doesn't look that easy, but it is. Not too hard, at least. OK. And the key observation, well, there are many key observations, but one of them is that once you've rewritten this probability P as a convex decomposition, then the first thing to do, as I said, is to choose between having to do P1 or having to do P2. In other words, to choose one random bit with probability cosine square or sine square of theta over 2, but theta is distributed. But the first observation is a very, very, very old thing, which has been known, maybe found by von Neumann, but perhaps before him, I'm not sure. So it's really an old technique, which makes it possible to choose a random bit with a given probability, even if this probability is given to you as an approximation. So if you know, let's say if you want to toss a random bit with probability 1/3, and you know it's 1/3, it's not all that hard. But if instead of knowing it's 1/3, if you're only allowed to get the bits of 1/3 one by one, if you're not told ahead of time with infinite precision what is probability P with which you want to choose a random bit, so if you're told ahead of time but only given the bits of P one by one, then is it possible to get a random bit with exactly probability P, even though P is only given to you as an approximation? Arbitrary precise approximation, of course. And the relevance is that nobody knows this angle theta, which is the sum of all the theta i's. So this angle theta will have to be obtained by successive approximation by communication. So by the parties communicating bits of their theta i's, they will be able to get the bits of theta with with increasing precision. But even though they will never know theta exactly, because they can get theta with arbitrary precision, they can use this old technique to sample with probability exactly cosine squared theta over 2. And this again, is an old technique, but it's really beautiful. If you have not seen it, it's maybe the best thing you will get out of this talk. It's so simple and elegant. By the way, if we wanted to do that with real quantum mechanics, if all the parties wanted to get these bits with the correct probability using quantum mechanics instead of mathematics, but if they were given if each one was given his own angle with arbitrary precision but not exactly, it would not be possible. If you don't have the exact angle at which you must make your measurement, if you're only given approximations, and if you're only allowed to get better and better approximation, you can ask how many bits of the angles you can get. Well, if you do the measurement if you do an approximate measurement, because you haven't asked for all the bits, you've lost your state. You cannot do it again. So in fact, with physics and with entanglement, if you're only giving you angles of measurements with arbitrary precision as opposed to exactly, there's no way that you can get the exact sampling. It's kind of funny. We do better with a simulation than real life. Because with simulation, even if we get our angles bit by bit, we can get the exact distribution. Anyways, so let's take an example, which is to toss a bit B with some probability P. So with probability P, you want to get heads, and tails with probability 1 minus P. And here, again, this is what we want to do in the end. So P will be, let's say, cosine square of theta over 2. So we have this angle, but we only have it by successive approximations. And yet, we want to toss one Bernoulli, one random bit, with exactly this probability. So how do you do it? I'll show it with an example. Let's say that P is 1/3. First, the idea, the higher level idea, which would require knowing P exactly, is to choose a random uniform real value between 0 and 1, which already is an infeasible proposition. But I seem to be asking you to choose a real number, all the bits of it, between 0 and 1 at random, uniformly. It's ridiculous. But bear with me for a moment. So let's say that you're able to choose this random real number. Well, if you just do this test, if u is less than p, so if u is less than p, when u is random uniform between 0 and 1, if u is less than p, well, the probability that u is less than p is exactly p, obviously. So you do say heads, and otherwise you say tails. So if you were able, which is not reasonable, to choose a random number, a random real number, and if you're given p exactly, then it's obvious to choose thus a coin with probability p. But I want to do that without knowing p, with knowing p only as approximate, successive approximations, and without doing something as ridiculous as choosing a real number at random. And that's the old trick of von Neumann. And I'll explain with an example. Let's say p is 1/3. Binary is like this. So only, and let's say that u, let's say that the u that you would choose at random, let's say u you choose at random is this, right? And the algorithm would say if u is less than p, which it is, which is not here, u is bigger than p, as you can see, then we should return 1 because u is bigger than p. But we want to do that without needing u nor p with infinite precision. So what you do is you take the first, you go slice by slice, you take the first bit of u, so you just toss one random coin, not a random number. You toss one random coin, and you get the first bit of u, and then you ask, what's the first bit of p? And you get here that the first bit of p is equal to the first bit of u. So you go on, take another random bit, so you toss another single coin, and you get 1, unbiased coin. You get 1, and you ask for the second bit of u, of p rather, and the second bit of p, is, in this case, is again equal to your second random bit. So you go on again. You ask for, you toss a third random bit, you get a 0 this time, and you ask for the third bit of p, and the derivative of p is different. And as soon as this happens, you can tell that p is bigger than u. So you only had, in this case, you only had to toss three random bits and ask three bits of p, and you can answer p is bigger than u, and therefore I would say one. And on the average, it's fairly obvious, easy to see that on the average, you will need to ask for two random bits, and you need to ask two bits of p. So on the average, with only two bits, a two-bit approximation of p and two random bits, you get exactly p. You get just according to exactly probability p. There. Okay. Now, let's go back to the GHZ distribution. This is what we want to simulate. The first step is toss a random bit with probability cosine squared theta over 2. So we need approximations of cosine squared theta over 2. We need, on the average, two bits of this approximation. Well, it's not too hard to see. It's a calculation. Simple Taylor series, that in order to get k bits, in order to get k bits of this angle, get k bits of that, k bits of precision, it's enough to get k plus log n plus 4 bits of each of the angles. So if each party sends, let's see, k plus log n plus 4 bits of his own angle to a single party whom we call the leader. We elect one leader, that's the party number one is the leader. All the other parties send k plus log n plus 4 bits of their own theta I to the leader. And then the leader has enough information to determine k bits of precision of this angle. And since it's enough on the average of 2 bits of precision of this angle to decide to toss a coin with this probability, it's enough on the average to have, well, 2 plus log n plus 4, log n plus 6 bits from each party. So again, we have these n parties, and it's all of them are going to send a few bits of their theta i's to the leader, and using that, the leader will be capable of tossing a coin with the right probability to decide if we want to do p1 or p2. And so they each have to send about log n bits plus a small constant. There are n parties, so it's going to be n log n bits of communication. So n log n bits of communication suffices on the average to decide whether we want to do p1 or p2. And now we have to choose between p1 and p2. How do we do that? Well, I remind you that p1 and p2 look like this mess. And now the next thing to observe is that of course, the sum of square of these two is 1, because these are sine squared plus cosine squared equals 1. And it's very straightforward to see that the sum of the pi's is equal to the sum of the ai squares. And therefore, p1 is no bigger than the sum of p1 and p2. And then a very complicated algebraic calculation shows that this thing is, in fact, equal to twice half of itself. And the whole point is that this thing here, not counting it twice, this thing is a very easy to sample probability distribution. One has to verify mathematically it's a probability distribution, it's not too hard. And why is it easy to sample? Because to sample this, and when I say easy, I mean that the n parties by local calculation can, with a single bit of communication, can each get one bit so that all the bits together follow this distribution. In other words, collectively, they can sample B with this distribution with a single bit of communication. And the single bit is the leader. The leader chooses at random heads or tails, uniformly, and tells all the others. And if the leader has chosen heads, then they will all sample according to A1 square. And if you said tail, they would all sample according to A2 square. Therefore, any average would be the right thing. So all I have to tell you is how can they sample collectively according to A1 square? Well, A1 square, if you look at A1, A1 square is a product of squares of alphas and betas. And the alphas and betas are sines and cosines that involve only the angle of a given participant. So each participant, let's say to do A1 square, each participant will choose at random with probability alpha j square a bit, and will output to itself as his own bj plus 1 or minus 1, depending on whether he gets with what is sine square, if he gets with what is sine square, it would be plus 1, but the cosine square would be minus 1. But the point is that each participant can do that on his own. Once they've decided to do either A1 or A2. If they want to do A2, it's a different formula, but it's just as easy. So once the leader told them to do A1 or A2, each participant on his own can choose a random bit with the right probability distribution so that collectively the n bits, again, when I say bit is plus or minus 1, collectively the n bits follow the A1 square or the A2 square distribution. So it's easy to get this distribution by a purely local operations after a single bit of communication. But that's not what you want to do. You want to do this one. And now the last trick, that's an old trick of von Neumann. It's known as the rejection algorithm of von Neumann. This is known in stochastic processes and all that, that if you want to sample according to some distribution that seems to be hard to do, this was discovered in non-distributed context. One party knows, wants to do P. So what von Neumann found is that even though this may be hard to do, if it's bounded by a small constant times something easy to do, then the von Neumann rejection algorithm will give you this after, on the average, twice doing that. Twice because of this constant 2 here. And the way it works is as follows. Give me just a few more minutes. Now it's even more technical, but this is really, really old stuff. So we want to simulate in general. So forget about GHZ. In general, if we want to sample some distribution F, but we know some distribution G, which is easy to sample, so that F is bounded by a constant times G, then the way to do that is you sample according to G, and then you do a test, and then you also sample a random variable, a real random variable, which we will replace by approximation afterwards, between 0 and 1, and then you do this test. And if the answer is yes, if f of x is less than c times g of x times this uniform variable, then you have failed, and you start over again. But if this is not the case, you're done. Right? This is not an obvious thing. It requires a proof, but it's very well known, as I said. So in our case, and we expect to go around the loop c times on the average. So when c is small, we're in good business. So in our case, this x is b. So we want to sample this n bits. So we call it vector b instead of x. So that's with x by b. We want to simulate. So f of b. We want to sample b with probability p1. This distribution G, which is easy to do, is the one I said before. I just told you how to do that. The constant C is equal to 2. So we're entirely in business. And everything is fine except that, sampling B according to G is easy, as I said. Sampling U, of course, we don't want to do that because that's a real variable. We have to do that by successive approximations. But I won't get into detail of that. But the thing which is more crucial is we need to do this test. And everything until here can be done locally, except for, again, one bit of communication to decide if we want A1 square or A2 square. But except for that, all of this could be done locally by all the parties. But now we have to make this test to decide if we failed or succeeded. And this test will require communication. This test will require parties to send bits to the leader so the leader has enough information, enough bits of precision to decide if we've in fact, what's going to happen here is that the parties will send bits to the leader, and then the leader will be able to either say, oh, we have failed this von Neumann loop, and we have to start over again and go back at the top. Or the leader will be able to say, we've succeeded, and now every one of us can output his own B, and we're done. We have the right distribution. Or the leader will say, oh, I don't have enough bits to decide yet. Please send me more. And then each party will send one more bit to the leader, who will again decide whether he has enough bits, and if not, ask for more. But if yes, will know that either they've succeeded and it's finished, or you have to start all over back at the top of the loop. All right, so again, this will require about order of n bits from each party. This is not obvious, you have to do a calculation, but about order of n bits from each party will be enough for the leader to know whether he succeeds or not. And if he does not succeed, then you have to start again, but on the average, we only have to do it twice. So order n bits is enough per participant. We have n participants, so it's going to be n square bits, and that's where the n square bits come from. Okay, looks like this. I have no intention to go through this, of course. I just want to show you that even though it's not an obvious thing, it's not horrendously complicated either. It's all there. This algorithm does the whole thing. All right, so just one couple more minutes to tell you about a parallel version. I won't get into detail, but the idea is simple and elegant, I think. What we've done so far is this. We had n parties, and they each had to send a bunch of bits to the leader. And the leader has to wait, he has to get all these bits. So it's not reasonable to claim that they all send their bits in parallel to the leader, because the leader would be overwhelmed receiving bits from everyone at the same time. So they really have to do it one bit at a time. But if we allow a model in which they can communicate with each other as opposed to all send their things to the leader, if we do it in a tree-like version like this, where in the first step, each half the parties send their bit to the other half, and then each party, by receiving bits from his twin and his own bits, can calculate something that he can send up the tree at a second round. So if we do it right, it's not very difficult. If we do it right, then each party gets a bit or a few bits from one level below, computes something with his own bits, and send it up one level up. And in the end, the leader, there's still a leader, but in the end, the leader will get exactly the same information that he would have gotten if everybody had talked to him. Enough information to decide what to do. But it's entirely reasonable to consider that this communication and this one can be done in parallel. There's no problem there. So in the end, we only need log n levels. Therefore, it's going to each of these will require n bits of communication, but it's going to be n bits times log n levels, so n log n time. In the case of equatorial measurements, I didn't explain how to do that more efficiently, but it goes down to log square n. So in less than linear, much less than linear time, we can simulate the equatorial measurement that before required n square time. So big improvement here. All right, open problems. Is it work? Could we get n log n for the general von Neumann measurement, as opposed to just for equatorial? Can we reduce from n squared to n log n? More interesting, can we do worst case communication as opposed to expected case? That we have no idea. All the techniques that I've told you about, because they're based on the von Neumann idea, and the von Neumann idea is fundamentally an expected case idea. So I have we don't have any technique that would allow us to do anything like this with worst case bounded communication as opposed to expected case. And therefore, the fact that we can do it with only 3 bits worst case in the case of tripart IGHZ, as Gisin has found, that is absolutely not subsumed by anything we've done. How about more general multipart I state? Not just GHZ, but more general, like the W state of Werner. Well, we're working on that, we've been able to, we know how to do a Wernher state now. In fact, I think that, I haven't checked the details yet, but I think that we can do an arbitrary n-partite state at this point with bounded communication. But some states, some depends on the state and the measurement. In some cases, we might need an exponential amount of communication at this point. But still, it's bounded, bounded expected. This requires, I mean, we're working on that. And how about doing not only Feynman measurements, but arbitrary, more general measurements? That's also open. All right, thanks. Any questions?
So, questions?
Yep.
Thanks. So you said you don't cover the case of teleportation.
What about teleportation?
You said that you don't cover the case of teleportation.
No, that's right.
But if any experiment which involves teleportation would in fact have, you know, some number of sites with people making measurements and so on and so forth. So could you imagine teleportation to be included in the most general sort of scenario you describe here on this last slide?
Well, don't think so. The general scenario, like here, when I say a more general state, but the whole point of this study is what can you do with only classical communication? And no amount of classical communication will allow you to teleport a quantum state.
No, but to verify that you've teleported the quantum state, you would have some measurements. So any experiment that involves, you know, actually involves teleportation would have measurements
I see,
in it.
I see. All right, so let me see if I got it. Let's say that someone does a teleportation experiment and then once convinced you that he's succeeded by telling you, all right, now I've teleported, choose your measurements, and I will get the right answer, thus convincing you that my teleportation was correct.
Right, yeah.
But the bastard, in fact, did not teleport anything, and he's doing this kind of trick to simulate the measurement that you give him.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So you're absolutely right. That if you want to verify that someone else has correctly teleported, you better not, and he's allowing you to choose which measurements to make after teleportation, on what's been teleported and something else that it was entangled with or whatever, you better not allow that person to take his time to provide the answers, the outputs to these measurements that you provide. Because if you give him enough time, then he can simulate everything by classical communication.
Right, okay.
So, yes, good point, good point. Thank you.
So maybe a variant of that scenario. I mean, so what if you teleport the qubit and then, or the goal, the thing that you're simulating is you teleport the qubit, then you store it for a day, and then you measure. So there'd be, you know, in the first stage where you teleport, that involves a measurement. And then the second stage involves more measurements. And how much communication, I mean, can you maybe think of breaking up the communication into stuff that happens on the first stage and in the second stage?
You're not talking here about the risk that by the next day the state has decayed.
No, I'm imagining it's stored
right, okay.
Perfectly.
So we assume perfect quantum memory here.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, once teleportation is done and you have everything at the same place, then there's no issue of communication anymore.
Right, but they didn't actually teleport. They're doing the simulation.
No,
the question is, do they have to wait until the next day to do the whole simulation, or can they break it up into two pieces?
Well, okay. I would say that all of these techniques that I've investigated because they require communication in not only one-way communication. If you want to do it across time instead of across space, and if you don't allow yourself backward in time communication, you'll be in trouble. Mm-hmm. So in this case, there is not very much communication from the leader to the other parties. Almost all the communication is from the parties to the leader, but the leader has to, there are two things the leaders need to tell the parties. One is, when you have to see, you remember this A1 squared plus B2 squared over 2, well, the leader has to tell them to do A1 squared or A2 squared. That's one bit, only one bit, but it goes from the leader to the parties. But more importantly, it's the leader who knows if he's succeeded in the von Neumann iteration, and the leader has to tell the other parties, please send more bits, or that's enough, stop. So if you want to do that with a pre-processing stage before you actually have the measurements, I don't think that any of these techniques could apply. Now, it doesn't mean that nothing else can be done. I don't know. It's a good question. I'd be doubtful, but it's worth investigating. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, then let's thank you again.